This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
I want to welcome all of you this morning to the court session at Black Hills State University. On behalf of the South Dakota Supreme Court, we're appreciative of the opportunity to have court here at Black Hills State University, and we're grateful for the university opening and providing great accommodations for us these next couple of days to hold court. Today we'll be hearing three cases that are set for oral argument, and we'll have three tomorrow as well. In between each case, there'll be about a 10-minute break, and when we get done with the three cases with argument this morning, we'll have about a 30-minute question and answer session, if you want to stick around for that. We won't talk about the cases that were argued, but if you have questions about what the court does, how the court process works, we invite you this is your opportunity to do that when we get done with the cases for oral argument. We have several high schools here this morning in attendance. We want to welcome Tokini High School, Rapid City Stevens AP Government class, Rapid City Central, Bison High School, and Wall High School as well. The first case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Charles and Heather Gustafson. It's appeal number 3073723. Carla Engel is appearing on South Dakota on behalf of the South Dakota Department of Transportation. Will be arguing. Dustin DeBoer is also present, and Clint Stargent is present. Will be arguing on behalf of the Gustafson. Each side will have 15 minutes for initial argument, and then Ms. Engel, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. With that, you can proceed, Ms. Engel.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Carla Engel, and here with Dustin DeBoer, I'm representing the state of South Dakota. This case is an eminent domain case. Very briefly, the facts are as follows. In 2020, the state began the reconstruction of the interchange at Interstate 29 and 41st Street in Sioux Falls. To build the project, the state condemned part of the Gustafson's real property adjacent to the interstate on-ramp. In addition to compensation for the taking of their land and the resulting damage to their remaining property, the trial court ruled that landowners were entitled to compensation for the closure of the public highway intersection of Carolyn Avenue and 41st Street next to landowners' property. The state has appealed, and the issue for review is, did the trial court err in determining the state's closing of a public highway intersection was a compensable taking or damaging of landowners' private property? This court has said a property right must be invaded before compensation is allowed, and whether a property right has been infringed is a question of law for this court, which this court also reviews without deference to the trial court's conclusion. In support of the trial court's ruling, landowners make three arguments to this court. First, they claim that they have special rights of access to 41st Street because their property abuts that street. Secondly, they claim they acquired special rights of access to 41st Street due to a 1958 agreement between the state and a prior owner of the property. And thirdly, they claim access to their property has been substantially impaired due to changes in the highest and best use of the property. None of those arguments will withstand review on appeal. I'd like to begin by talking about their claim that they retained special private rights of access to 41st Street, where their land abuts 41st. State law, specifically South Dakota Codified Law Chapters 31.7 and 31.8, and this court's precedents in the Morris case, recognizes that a landowner can grant away their special rights to the state, and that's what landowners' predecessor did. At the trial on the takings issue, landowners conceded that the state acquired access control across the property's entire 41st Street frontage, both in landowners' counsel opening and his closing, found at the court trial transcript pages 9 and 10, and page 175. And landowners also submitted two post-trial briefs, and nowhere in those briefs did landowners make the argument that they retained their access rights to 41st Street from the property's 1958 frontage. Arguments not made to the trial court are considered waived on appeal and will not be addressed. So the claim landowners make throughout their appellate brief that they retained special rights of access where their property abuts 41st Street, those claims should be disregarded because landowners conceded their predecessor had conveyed away those rights. But landowners did argue at trial that they owned a property right to the intersection itself. They claimed that a plat that had been recorded after 1958 extended the east property line to the center line of Carolyn Avenue. So they argued that they actually had a property right to the right-of-way of Carolyn Avenue itself.
So it doesn't appear that is an issue on appeal. So if you could address the intersection question, and it seemed like the application, whether or not our decision in the Hall case applies here, if you could address that, please.
Yes, thank you. So there was a 1958 agreement and plat and plans that governed the acquisition of right-of-way in 1958. And landowners make a couple of arguments with regard to that. One, they say that the Hall analysis is satisfied, and that is simply not the case. So in the Hall case, the state, by its own appraisal, determined that the landowner was entitled to damages due to severance caused by the new interstate that the state was building. But the state didn't pay those severance damages because the state concluded that the new interchange they were building would confer special property rights to the landowner. And those special property rights would offset the severance damage. So in other words, in Hall, the government paid the landowner less compensation than they were owed because of the new interstate that the government was building. But you won't find those facts here. So the third element of the Hall case requires that there be that mitigation of damage, that there be more damage owed to the landowner that isn't actually paid. But there was absolutely no evidence in the record that that had occurred. In fact, the evidence submitted indicated that landowner had been paid in full for the land that had been acquired, landowner's predecessor had been paid in full for the land acquired and any damage. So there was no mitigation of damage as required in Hall. And secondly, Hall involved a new project feature that offset damage. And here, landowners aren't talking about a new project feature. They're talking about something that existed before the 1958 project and something that existed after the 1958 project. So there's no new project feature. And finally, under Hall, you have to show special injury. And special injury means an injury peculiar to your land that's different in kind and not merely degree from that's suffered by members of the public. But here, what landowners lost was access to the street system. And this court has said in the Schlimm case that no landowner has a right to a particular access route through the system of streets.
What about the circuit court's determination that the mitigation in 1958 was leaving access to 41st Street intact, and that itself was mitigating, and then when they took that, of course, now they have to pay for something that they previously left intact. How does that fit within Hall 2?
Thank you, Your Honor. There was no mitigation because you have to have actually a reduction of damages that are owed, and that wasn't the case here. But in addition, I would like to talk about what the landowner actually had in 1958, both before and after that project. So this court has said that a landowner has two access-related rights. One is the right to access an abutting conventional street, and the second is the right to get somewhere once you get on that abutting street, the right of access to the system of streets. So in 1958, landowners' predecessor had access to Carolyn Avenue. Now, before the project, they also had a right of access to 41st, which they weren't exercising. And so they had access to Carolyn.
Because they abutted 41st Street at that time.
Yes. So they had access to Carolyn Avenue, and then they had access to the larger street system through the Carolyn Avenue 41st Street intersection. After the 1958 project, landowners granted away their special rights of access to 41st Street, but they still had access to abutting Carolyn Avenue and access to the larger street system.
So it's not that they mitigated, in your view anyway. It's not that the state mitigated it in 1958. They just didn't take it. They
exactly.
didn't have to pay for anything. There was
yes.
no damage to pay for or mitigate or reduce as a result of a special benefit.
That's precisely right, Justice Salter. And this court has said when they're analyzing whether a private property right has been taken, they look at the infringement of private property by state conduct. That's talked about in Miller and Legacy Land and Schlimm. What exactly was the state conduct in 1958 that left things as they were? So landowners want to convince this court that you should be focused on what existed in 1952. But the state conduct at issue happened in 2020, and that was the closure of the Carolyn Avenue 41st Street intersection. So the court should be looking at the facts in 2020, not 62 years earlier. And the facts in 2020 were that there were numerous streets, at least four, that besides 41st Street, that intersected with Carolyn Avenue in 2020. And the evidence was undisputed that all manner of vehicles could maneuver through those other intersections and both reach the property and leave the property.
So the special damages inquiry then focuses on what happened in the closure of the intersection. They have to show special damages. It seems like that's kind of similar then, and maybe move on to the next argument they're making on the substantial impairment, which also requires you to show a unique injury, injury that is not common to the public. So can you explain why, in the view of the state, that is not established or was not established in the record?
Yes, Justice Devaney, I'll be happy to discuss that. So this court has said a reduction in value resulting from diversion of traffic is non-compensable, as is mere circuity of travel. So to the extent that landowners are complaining that they've lost traffic coming to or from 41st Street, that is non-compensable.
Are you saying circuity is never compensable?
So circuity of travel is different than diversion of traffic, Chief Justice
okay.
Jensen.
So tell me about security of traffic. That can be compensable depending upon the extent to which you have to twist and turn and get to where you want to get to.
That's absolutely correct. The difference between mere circuity and substantial impairment is a matter of degree. But examining the facts in this case, it is not so onerous. The circuity of travel here is not so onerous, in the words of this court in Legacy Land, as to justify compensation.
Isn't it uniquely factually dependent, I mean, to each case? I mean, here we've got a route that was 200 some yards or feet. Now we've got a half a mile that the traveling public has to make in total, and three changes of direction. Isn't that quite a circuitous path to get to the designation now?
Justice Kern, I believe the proper consideration is the distance between the 41st intersection with Carolyn Avenue and the 38th Street intersection with Carolyn Avenue. That's what the court measured and considered in the Schlimm case. In Schlimm, the landowner had access to busy Cliff Avenue, about 750 feet away. And after the state built its project, the landowner had access to National Avenue about 850 feet away, and which was an industrial low-traffic area. But this court concluded that was not a substantial impairment. In this case, landowners had a 200-foot access route to get to 41st. In the after condition, they have an 838-foot route to get to 38th Street.
You can finish what you're saying.
That's a difference of 638 feet or 12/100ths of a mile.
And I assume the reason that you look at that distance instead is because they have no special right of direct access to 41st Street. So instead, the right that they maintain would be the right to be able to get out to access the larger system of streets.
That's precisely right, Justice Devaney. I couldn't have said it better.
Our cases seem to talk about circuity of travel really generically. And, you know, the evidence in this case, as you know, focused on some of this highest best use evidence and the realtors and that sort of thing. But it made me think, and I understand your argument and both sides' arguments in that regard, but it made me think a little bit about, is it a universal concept, circuity of travel? Or does the type, the volume, the character, what kind of travel might be impacted? Does that matter? In other words, you can get to it, and we know the amount of additional distance, but does it so severely impact the likelihood that the same kind of people are going to go there, patronize that area, be there? Does that matter? I don't think our cases make that distinction, so I'll admit maybe it's an unfair question.
Your Honor, I think it's a very good question. So in my view, circuity of travel really gets to function. And this court has repeatedly said, we're not looking at damage when we're determining whether a private property right has been taken. We're looking at whether or not people can get to the property through the system of streets. Thank you.
Mr. Sargent, you can proceed with your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. This court has said that whether a compensable taking of access has occurred is dependent on the unique circumstances in each case. And clearly, that's what we have here. And the most significant fact, which at the trial level I didn't believe was in dispute, is whether the state took and paid for the closure of the Carolyn Avenue intersection. You'll see in the record, I mean, that was a big deal at the start. We stipulated that they didn't take, in 1958, the state did not take control of access across the Carolyn Avenue intersection. In my examination of Mr. Gangler on behalf of the state, I asked him, is there any evidence that the state paid the Egans for that? There wasn't. There wasn't any that was found. And Judge Song found that, well, of course, the Egans' access through that intersection wasn't taken because they wouldn't have any other access. If you look at the exhibits, that's why we put in all those historical photos, that it wasn't until the 1970s or 80s where you could access this property anywhere other than the Carolyn Avenue intersection. So if you start from that fact, that for decades the only way to access that property was through the Carolyn Avenue intersection, you have to reach the same conclusion that Judge Song did, is that when the state took control of access for Interstate 29, which did include the southern border because that was the on-ramp, and it not only affected the Egan's property but also the property to the east of the intersection, the Christensen's property, the state specifically on the plans and on the plat left that intersection open.
So do you think any of that is a legal question? or do we give any deference to Judge Song's determination on that?
Well, no, I think that's a factual determination, right? What was paid for and what the agreement was, that's a factual determination that Judge Song got right.
So now, in the documents for that transaction, we have the amount paid that was broken up into the amount paid for the actual acreage taken, and then there is an amount there for damages, but we don't have any delineation in the record or an identification of what that damage amount included or did not include. Unlike in the Hall case, where we've got an appraisal where that specifically said, we recognize this special benefit here and we are offsetting your amount of damages because of that. So in this record, we don't have anything like that. Well, so are we to just assume that happened? It seemed like that's what the court did.
No. We tell juries all the time that there's no difference between direct and circumstantial evidence, right? I mean, we tell them that. There isn't any. And the circumstantial evidence that was presented at trial leads to a clear conclusion that they weren't paid for that. And Justice, here's how. Mr. Gangler testified that almost all the properties on that project in 1958 were paid some damage, that this property went from a 20-acre rectangle to now a very oddly shaped property. It lost 600 feet of frontage along the section line, went down to 100 feet. So there was clear damage to the property that would be separate from access. And circumstantially, you can conclude that if they were taking all access to 41st Street, then they were taking all access to the property. And damages would have had to have been much more, almost a complete taking, if the state was taking the right to deny all access to the property, which would have only been through 41st Street.
Well, there was other damage as well that was referenced, for the easements and so forth, but there was no evident testimony in the record of here's what something like that would have amounted to in value at that time. I mean, it still seems like we have to make another assumption when you look at the amounts, not just, okay, well, let's assume they did get it, but where is it here?
And the court pointed to Hall, and I would point you to the first case cited in Hall, which was Filler, where the North Dakota Supreme Court said, when we see these plats and plans, and there are designated access points, and there's no evidence to the contrary, the court should assume that was part of the deal, that those access points were part of the deal. So, we never, as lawyers or judges, want to assume anything, but there is case law cited in Hall where it said, no, that is exactly what you should do, and it makes sense because, especially when we have to look back often, 50, 60 years, back when documentation wasn't the same as it is now, and we have situations where the lawyers aren't negotiating these deals. It's land agents negotiating them with ordinary citizens, right? And so we have to look at it as, what makes the most sense? If you look at the plans and the plat and you tell me I'm still going to have access here at this intersection, I can rely on that.
So Filler was a case like Hall, though. That was an abutting landowner where they actually put in a frontage road with specific access points on the frontage road.
And I think
and then a later closure. It wasn't a direct access. Now we're talking about an indirect access, which is still a right. But it's a right to get you to the rest of the network of highways to get off of your property. So it's a little bit different in that respect, right?
And I apologize for interrupting you continuously.
That's fine.
I think Filler is actually more analogous to this case than Hall, because in Filler you had a situation where there was a landowner abutting a highway and had access. And then the state took a strip of its border and then said, we're going to put a frontage road in here with access points. I think that's more similar here is that they took a strip on the southern border, and the access point that is remaining is the Carolyn Avenue intersection.
So one thing I noticed, the option agreement there specifically refers and talks about expressly reserving the right to access along what is now 41st, if the state would ever determine to put in a frontage road or service roads there. So there's language in there where they expressly reserved that right in the event that occurred in the future. There's no mention at all in the actual option agreement, even though it talks about those, that they reserve this express right to the indirect access through what is now Carolyn Avenue. What do we make of that?
Well, First Justice, I take you back to the standard of review. And what the agreement was, I believe, is a question of fact. And Judge Song's determination as to what the agreement was isn't clearly erroneous. That based on all of the facts and circumstances as to what went on between these parties and what was testified to by DOT's representative at the trial, as well as looking at the documents, that it was the court's determination. We had proven beyond our burden that the agreement was they preserved the right to that access right through Carolyn Avenue was part of the agreement based on the plans, the plats, and everything that was considered.
Go ahead, please. If we agree with what you've just argued, then you still have to address the special damages question, which is also one of the factors that Hall noted. You still have to show that. And is the focus of whether there's now special damages now in 2020 when they close the intersection?
Let me address that. And I addressed it in our brief as it relates to substantial impairment of access. We do not need to prove peculiarity based on this court's holding in Miller and then the reaffirmed in Legacy. The quote is specifically, if the change in access amounts to a substantial impairment and is caused by the physical taking of landowner's property, the landowner is entitled to compensation for substantial impairment. Okay, that's in Miller and in Legacy Land.
I'm just wondering how did the intersection was not their property. There wasn't a, that's not part of the physical taking here.
What I would submit is this type of language is to differentiate a takings case like this, where they're taking a huge chunk of the southern part of this property to make a cul-de-sac. They're closing off one of the accesses to Carolyn Avenue. This is peculiar, right? I mean, as a matter of law, that's peculiar if you're taking all of this. And so Justice Severson, when he wrote it and when this court affirmed it, repeated it in Legacy, is saying if that property is physically taken, we don't also have to determine peculiarity. That's what the court's written.
I thought that depended whether the taking of the property is what affects the access. I guess I read that a different way, that if the access issue is not part of the physical taking, then you do have to show substantial impairment. It seemed like that's exactly what was the issue was in Miller.
Well, what I would say is if that language doesn't apply to this case, I don't know what case it would, because I want to go just for a second and talk about the important distinction between taking a special private right of access, right, that we're claiming in this case that, again, I'm not denying that control of access was granted. What I'm saying is that the Egans had a special private right of access, and they retained a special private right of access through the intersection.
Okay, you're talking now about the Egans, not the Gustafsons.
But it transfers. It's an inherent right that goes with the landowner, and that's in Hall. I mean, the state made that argument in Hall that the Egans, that the prior landowner's rights don't transfer to the new, and they do. I mean, it's an inherent property right that when I buy a property, whatever the rights of the predecessor are, they're my rights, right? And so the Gustafsons' rights are the same as the Egans. In 2020, the Gustafsons had whatever rights the Egans had in 1958. And so that's why where we really got in a disagreement with the state is really the legal analysis here. If there is a special private right of access that an abutting landowner has, they do have the right to a particular route. An abutting landowner has a right to a particular route to access the abutting highway. And that was in Schlemm. Our position is the Egan's had that right. And if we're going to do the Hall analysis, the feature in the project was to maintain that right and to allow them to access it through that intersection.
That's
the feature.
That's kind of a question that I have. Perfect. So because the mitigation element of Hall has to relate, as I read it, to an aspect of the project that specifically benefits the property. Okay, so you mitigate, that's mitigating, right?
Right.
We would ordinarily have to pay X, but because this project is going to specially benefit the landowner, we don't have to pay as much. We
right.
can mitigate that. But here, the taking in 1958 as a result of that project just left the access intact. They already had it. So how does that project mitigate the amount of money that the state would have already had to have paid?
Well, first I'd say, I agree, they didn't take it, and so we still have it. So we don't need to get into the Hall analysis. The Hall analysis is relevant in my mind because it talks about how to interpret these options agreements.
But mitigating is reducing the damages. This argument is we just didn't have to pay as much because we didn't landlock. That seems different.
I don't think it's different. I think it's semantical, really. If you say we're not taking this and so we don't have to pay you for it, that's the same as, well, we're not taking all of your access, and we're going to mitigate that by giving you this access point.
I understand your argument, but the project, would you agree, the project in 1958 didn't give them anything they didn't already have?
Correct. It maintained that access point. And when we say that's not a feature, look at the plans. Look at the plat. It specifically, it shows the on-ramp going past the Egan's and to the Christensen's. And that feature is that there's going to be a road here going north and south so that you can still come in from the section line 41st Street. That's a feature, okay? And what is that mitigating? Well, if we would have continued that on-ramp and not given you any access, then we've denied you all access to your property.
But the feature,
we're mitigating that.
But the project didn't create that feature. It left it intact. And so when you see that, you see evidence of something that was already there. They just didn't have to pay that much.
Right. But the language in Hall doesn't say that the project created a feature. It just says that there is a feature. There's a feature of the project. There's a fact of the project. There's something about the project that the people relied on. The Egan's relied on that feature in negotiating in 1958, and everybody can rely on that going forward. And then if they eliminate that feature, they eliminate that access point, okay, now we have a new taking. And that's what Hall is really about, and that's what this case is about, is that there's been a second taking, that the taking in 1958 did not include taking the Egan's right to access 41st Street. And now in 2020, when the state comes in and does it, that's a second taking. And
so in Hall, same scenario that you're arguing occurred here, and the fifth factor that our court determined had to be met in Hall is that now when what was the special benefit is taken away, now you have special damages. And so they didn't say, just damages. They did require special damages. So isn't that the requirement? It still has to be something now that it's closed that is unique and not the same thing in common with the general public.
You can answer the question and then wrap up.
Judge Song found that it was special. If you look at his conclusions of law, he concluded that there was special damage, and I'll say this is what it is. There is no evidence in the record that any other landowner lost virtually the equivalent of direct access to 41st Street as a result of this project. There is no evidence that anyone else lost their 41st Street address as a part of this project. There is no evidence that anybody else had their property, which was a high-density retail property, transformed into a low-density commercial. And the state's own appraiser made that factual conclusion. So that is why this landowner is peculiar. And I know that the state always argues, well, the general public, it doesn't affect them. And what I would say is, why is the difference that my client suffered, why is it different in kind? My client's interest in being able to rent his property to Pizza Hut because of its convenient access is absolutely different in kind than my daughter's right to conveniently buy pizza. They're not the same. They're totally different.
Thank you, Mr. Sargent.
Thank you.
Ms. Engel, you may proceed with rebuttal.
I'd like to begin by talking about the standard of review. Mr. Sargent mentioned that the option agreement is in the evidence and that disturbing any conclusions by the trial court with regard to the option agreement would need to be applied by the clearly erroneous standard. But the language of the option agreement is not disputed. It's the legal effect of the option agreement. Did it create a private property right? That's the question for this court, and that's a legal question that's reviewed without deference to the trial court. I also would like to address Mr. Sargent's assertion that the 1958 agreement with landowner's predecessor granted a private property right. And what landowners point to is paragraph 3 of the option agreement. And they say that that option agreement means that the prior landowner released any claim for damages only so long as the state maintained the intersection in accordance with the plans. And the right-of-way taking was conditioned on the intersection remaining unaffected. But if you review the option agreement, which is found at Settled Record 501, there is absolutely no conditioning language like landowners have added in their argument. There is no so long as language. Rather, the language they're focused on was a release. It was a release by landowner's predecessor, not a grant by the state. If the state was granting a private property right to the intersection, it should be explicit, or they need to meet the requirements of the Hall case. And neither is satisfied here. In addition,
can you address, I don't want you to run out of time, the argument that was made at the end as to why the Gustafsons believe that they have shown a special, a unique damage that is not in common with the rest of the public?
Yes, absolutely, Justice Devaney. So that's really an argument about degree. Not difference in kind. Landowners are arguing that the impact on them is different than the general public, but that's not the test. They have to show a different injury in kind, and that's what they failed to do. Once their predecessor granted away all of their special rights to 41st Street, they were like the rest of the public. Now we're just talking about access through the system of streets. And unless they can show that that access is a substantial impairment, as opposed to simply mere circuity, they cannot show entitlement to damages in this case.
I had a question. So the appraisal that's in the record, and I think one of the parties, it may have been the Gustafson, listed, there's 9 things that are listed that are shown that how the property has changed. And when I looked at that, so there are those things, and that included things like the 41st Street access, the loss of the signage, the visibility, those sorts of things. And then under that were things that were, it was mentioned, and these are the things that the state has deemed non-compensable and referring to the access. So were the things, and I know this is not the issue on appeal, but that argument made me wonder. It seemed like some of those things were part of the potential compensability, but that didn't relate to access, but other types of damages. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Justice Devaney, I would say that the appraiser's statement about the overall impact of the project, whether compensable or not, is irrelevant. In fact, the appraiser's conclusions shouldn't come in until the damages phase of this case. And so at the takings phase, issues related to measures of damages are totally irrelevant. And landowners did try to argue that a change in the highest and best use of their property translated to the taking of a private property right. But this court has consistently rejected landowners who try to use valuation evidence in order to prove the infringement of a private property right. And
so let me ask you this. When it comes to substantial impairment, one of the factors we look at is the nature of the property involved. How is that different than highest and best use?
If I may, Your Honor. So substantial impairment, when we talk about the nature of the property, we're looking at, can the access still function and serve the property? So I would refer the court to the Texland case, which was cited in Miller. In that case, the property before the state project had trucks that came to the property several times a day. After the state project, trucks couldn't reach the property. That's an example of how the nature of the property can inform whether the access route still functions. And critically here, there was no evidence to show that the remaining access routes couldn't function and serve the property.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.